please, let this thing be over soon.
Well, good luck with that. It may take forever between now and next week.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Oh, that's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it's not.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
Yeah, still a little scared.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Clowns and jokers,
yes,
beware.
I'm stuck in the middle.
We're back
with you.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. This is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM. People-powered radio in L.A., up in Oregon on 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast and 88.5 FM KAKU, the voice of Maui. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN 94.1 FM. In Palenville, New York on 102.9 FM WLPP. Up in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota. And streaming coast to coast and around the globe on the internets. On the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Revolution 99, Detour Talk, Radio Monterey, and Radio Sputnik. Trying to make some sense of it all. Blanketing Planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us. And my thanks to Angie Coiro for filling in for us on yesterday's thrilling broadcast. Much appreciated. If all goes well, that's me and Desi. Hello, Desi Doyen.
Hello.
We will be back with you every weekday between now and the apocalypse. I mean, the election day next week, 1 week from today. It is now the beginning of November, and we are mercifully, as I say, just 1 week from Election Day. Finally. But remember the beginning of October just 1 month ago? Seems like forever ago. It really does. Just 1 month ago, but it seems like ages. In any event, here's how John Oliver described where we were at the time in this crazy election 1 month ago this week.
Just do me a favor. Look up into the sky right now. Higher. No, higher still. Do you see that? Way up there. Way up above the clouds. That's rock bottom. And we are currently way down here. Not that it makes it any better.
So that was the beginning of October, the beginning of the month of October. The following week, just after the Donald Trump, Billy Bush, Access Hollywood video emerged, that hadn't even happened when John Oliver had said that rock bottom was way up there. So the following week, that video hit, and here was John Oliver on HBO's Last Week Tonight the next week.
Yes. That is audio of Donald Trump in 2005 telling a giggling Billy Bush that one of the perks of fame is that he can grab women's genitalia without permission. And let me just remind you that last Sunday, I told you if you looked above the clouds, you would see rock bottom. But if you look up there now, just way, way, way up there, all the way up high, you will see right up in the distance where we were this time last week. Because since then, we have sunk so low, we are breaking through the Earth's crust, where drowning in boiling magma will come as sweet, sweet relief.
Now, of course, that was several weeks ago. This past Sunday on Last Week Tonight on HBO with John Oliver, here's how he put where we are right now.
To recap, the grinding hell of this election has thrown in yet another twist, with the election potentially hanging in the balance, all thanks to the fact Anthony Weiner allegedly sexted with a 15-year-old girl. Now, a month ago, when Donald Trump tweeted, "We should check out a sex tape of a former Miss Universe contestant," I said if you looked up, you would see rock bottom. Well, if you look up now, you will see absolutely nothing, and I'll tell you why. We have burrowed through not just rock bottom, but through the core of the earth. and we've come bursting out the other side, startling kangaroos, and we're currently hurtling toward outer space where there is no up, down, light or darkness, just an endless void in which death comes as sweet, sweet relief. Please, let this thing be over soon.
Now, kind of, I think everyone in this country may feel that way right around now. But speaking about hurtling through Earth, this feeling, this has not been, new just the last month. This has been going on for a long time. And to give you a reminder of that, I went back to a story back from July. I mean, if October seems like forever ago, July.
Well, that was like 50 years
ago. Oh, that was, yeah. July, the beginning of July 2016, this was, let's see, how much do some people hate the idea of a president Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump? Apparently enough that a bunch of people polled by public policy polling at the time. This was actually, the poll was actually in late last June. Enough of those people said that they would rather die in an apocalyptic event than see either President Hillary Clinton or President Donald Trump. At least according to the June survey by the left-leaning public policy polling, you may remember this, 13% of the people who were polled would rather have a giant meteor hit Earth than elect Clinton or Trump. The exact question in the poll at the time was, quote, if the choices for president were Democrat Hillary Clinton, Republican Donald Trump, and a giant meteor hitting the Earth, which would you choose? Well, at the time, in late June, about 43% chose Clinton, 38% chose Donald Trump, 13% chose the giant meteor, and 7% weren't sure. unlike its Earth-based opponents, U.S. News and World Report had noted at the time, the giant meteor had pretty equal support across ideological lines. 21% of meteor supporters identified as somewhat or very conservative, 16% as moderate, 23% as somewhat or very liberal. And that was the same across political parties. 8% of Democrats and 8% of Republicans were in favor of the meteor at the time, and a staggering 27% of independents supported the meteor at the time. That was in June, and now mid-October, the meteor has returned. It actually picked up a Twitter handle, Giant Meteor 2016. There are bumper stickers out there for it.
Yes, I've seen them.
And it's still the case, even in mid-October, a lot of young Americans, according to Reuters, were so dissatisfied with their choices in the election that nearly one in four young voters told one opinion poll that they would rather have a giant meteor destroy the Earth and see Trump or Clinton in the White House. This was the UMass Lowell's Center for Public Opinion, I guess, picked up what PPP had started earlier this year. And apparently when they were talking to young voters, some 53% of more than 1,200 people aged 18 to 35 said they would prefer to see a meteor destroy the world than have Republican New York real estate developer Donald Trump in the Oval Office. 53% preferred the meteor over Trump. Just 34% preferred the planetary annihilation to seeing Democratic former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton win. But that's 23%, nearly one in four. Preferred the giant meteor to either Trump or Clinton. When asked to choose between the actual candidates taking out the meteor from the equation, Clinton easily led amongst this group of young voters, or perhaps hopeful voters. We'll see if they vote. Clinton led that group 54-21% in a two-way race. She led 48-20% among young voters in a four-way race, with Libertarian Gary Johnson picking up 10% among young voters and Green Party Jill Stein picking up 4% in that poll. So that was in mid-October. Here's a news item. On Sunday, NPR reported a large space rock came fairly close to Earth.
What? Yeah. Mr. Meteor decided to take a visit?
Yes. Fortunately, it didn't hit Earth. That's a good. See, there's some good news on today's program. The astronomers figured that out in advance, thanks in part to a new tool that NASA is developing for detecting potentially dangerous asteroids. That's a good thing. Of course, if we cut all of the government spending, then we'd have less money to find objects that may be about to hit Earth. And in this case, this thing was actually only discovered just days ago. The tool that discovered it is a computer program called Scout. It's being tested at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory out here in Pasadena, California. NPR says Scout is, think of it as a celestial intruder alert system, constantly scanning data from telescopes to see if there are any reports of so-called near-Earth objects. I guess that would be Giant Meteor 2016. If it finds one, it makes a quick calculation of whether Earth is at risk and instructs other telescopes to make follow-up observations and so forth. NASA pays for several telescopes around the planet. Thank you, NASA. To scan the skies on a nightly basis looking for these objects, according to astronomer Paul Chodas of JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Objects can come close to the Earth shortly after discovery, sometimes one day, 2 days, even hours in some cases. In this case, the rock that whizzed past the Earth on Sunday, October 30, was discovered on the night of October 25 and 26. By the NASA-founded Panoramic Survey Telescope and Rapid Response System on Maui, Hawaii. Hey there, KAKU, our affiliates out in Maui. Thanks, guys. Appreciate that. Scout did a quick analysis and determined that the object was headed for Earth, but would miss us by about 310,000 miles. But that's pretty close in
that's surprisingly
astronomical terms. They were also estimate that the object was somewhere between 5 and 25 meters. That program, Scout, is dealing with smallish objects.
So that's like as big as a building.
Yeah.
A house.
Well, 5 meters. 5 or 25 meters. Yeah, yeah. That actually is as big as a house. There's another system that's called Sentry that is trying to identify objects large enough to wipe out a major city or wipe out Earth in the next 100 years. Their goal is to find 90% of the 140-meter asteroids and larger, according to Chodas. Right now, he estimates we're only able to find about 25 to 30% of the estimated population of objects that size. That might come as good news to young voters who are rooting for that giant meteor. I, on the other hand, am not. But we did have a meteor of sorts strike the 2016 election on Friday, just as we were going to air. The unprecedented announcement made by the FBI Director James Comey that the agency was reviewing these newly discovered emails that could be related to their previous investigation of Hillary Clinton's email server. That news hit the 2016 presidential election much like a meteor, I think, or an asteroid that nobody saw coming. Now, how this incredibly unusual action by the FBI director in violation of the Department of Justice's own rules for avoiding election-related announcements and indictments and so forth in the weeks leading up to the election. How that will ultimately affect results, that remains to be seen, but it seems unlikely to be good news for Hillary Clinton, even if there's nothing there, as so far there is nothing there. Just as many folks were, sort of becoming complacent about the idea that Hillary Clinton is going to defeat Donald Trump, that news struck the cycle like a giant meteor. And that news has once again made a President Trump much more likely, as the polls had already begun to tighten up over the past week. There was a new national poll that came out Friday, finding the Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton had a 4-point advantage over Donald Trump nationally. This was on Friday. The ABC News Washington Post tracking poll found Clinton leading Trump 48% to 44% in a 4-way contest, with Gary Johnson getting 4%, Jill Stein getting 2%. So she had still that lead, according to that poll, by 4 points. But what's notable here is that lead, that 4-point poll, that was an 8-point drop in a single week last week. So the week prior to last week, Clinton had led in that same poll. Now, you can't make too much out of any one poll, but if you compare, you know, one poll one week and the same poll the week or the month before, now you're comparing apples to apples. And in this case, Clinton had led by as much as 12 points just 1 week earlier. So we saw an 8-point drop in 1 week in the ABC News Washington Post poll, and that was before the Comey letter on Friday. Keep that in mind, why don't you? The poll finds that, and here's the other I find a disturbing thing. The poll found that a majority of likely voters expect Clinton to win the election. 59% of respondents said that the former Secretary of State is likely to win the White House, while only 30% could say the same about Trump. So you had a lot of people out there thinking, oh, Hillary Clinton's going to win. It's all good. Nothing to worry about, at least if they were Clinton supporters. And again, that was before the Comey news, that 8-point plummet in that particular poll. Now, looking at that same poll today, Donald Trump is now 1 point ahead of Hillary Clinton. This for the first time in months, according to the ABC News Washington Post tracking poll. Trump is now leading Hillary Clinton among likely voters, 46% to 45%. The two candidates are divided by a slim 0.7% margin. That is well within the poll's margin of error. Trump had led Clinton only one other time in this ABC News Post tracking poll. This was back in May, shortly after he got the Republican nomination. At that time, Clinton and former Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders were still locked in their own primary battle. So not since then. And only then has Trump led in this poll, in this tracking poll, and now he is leading by 1 point over Hillary Clinton. This poll was conducted between October 27 and October 30. So that's 4 days, and a couple of them were before the James Comey, Hillary Clinton, the new email news, for whatever it's worth, before it had hit all of the... before it had smashed into the earth on Friday. Several days of the polling came after the news. So it's likely reflected a little bit in this poll, but it could even be reflected more so if it redounds to Trump's benefit, since a couple of the days in this poll took place before the asteroid hit. The Real Clear Politics average still shows Clinton up, but by not much, by a 2.4% margin, 2.4 percentage points, according to Real Clear Politics, which averages all the polls together. But as we always note on this program, the national popular vote numbers don't actually tell the story, because we have state by state elections here. And as Nate Silver at 538.com noted last night, he was looking at the polling numbers and comparing them to 2012. He said, we can compare Clinton's current margins in our forecast, which shows Hillary Clinton likely to beat Donald Trump at this point. He says, we can compare Clinton's current margins in our forecast against President Obama's performance in 2012. Clinton, despite Trump's recent improvement in the polls, leads by 4.7 points in the national popular vote, according to them last night. That's a wider margin, so she leads by more than Obama's 3.9-point victory over Mitt Romney in 2012. But he adds, Clinton is performing worse than Obama in 10 of the 12 states that are generally considered swing states back in 2012. You know, the states that actually matter. In some regard, you know, it doesn't matter if Hillary Clinton is going to win out here in California by a huge margin. It doesn't matter if she wins by 10 or 15 points or 5 points. She's still going to, you know, take all of the electorate electors from the state. It's the battlegrounds that are important. And in the battleground states, Clinton is performing worse than Obama did against Mitt Romney in 10 of the 12 states that were considered battlegrounds back in 2012. In some cases, such as Florida and Pennsylvania, the difference, he says, is negligible. But she's underperforming Obama substantially in Iowa, in Michigan, in Ohio, and in Nevada, and to somewhat lesser extent in Wisconsin and Minnesota. She's considerably outperforming Obama this year in Virginia and North Carolina, so there is that. But conversely, Silver adds, that is not enough to make up for her losses elsewhere. And remember, most of those numbers he's looking at were numbers that had come in prior to this James Comey asteroid on Friday.
What really concerns me about all of this is that there's still one more Friday news dump to go.
Yes.
Before election day.
There's a lot to go. Lot to go.
And lots can still happen.
Well, which is why I've been trying to point out here that overconfidence for anyone is a killer. Voters would be wise to presume absolutely nothing at this point, and I guess I have to just keep repeating that. Take nothing for granted. Polls only tell us so much. They don't tell us the effects of voter suppression, voter intimidation, at the polling place. We're going to talk a little bit more about that with my guest in a moment. They don't tell us about voting machines and computer tabulator failures, hacking, long lines. They don't tell us about the Bradley effect, those voters who will support Trump in the privacy of the voting booth, but they're too embarrassed to tell pollsters about it when they're asked. That could have an effect. You could see several percentage points more support for Donald Trump. And frankly, I think it's wise to presume this year that number will be much larger than is currently reflected in the polls, the support for Donald Trump. And then in the meantime, there's voter fraud. Remember, Donald Trump kept telling us that voter fraud is a huge, huge worry, that people are going in and voting 5 and 10 times if there's no photo ID, voting restrictions. All of that is, of course, completely untrue. There is a voter fraud, but it's generally via absentee voting. At the polling place, it is extraordinarily rare. But now, for some reason or another, Donald Trump has decided maybe he's okay with voter fraud as long as the voter fraud is in favor of him. Here was Trump speaking over the weekend in Cleveland, Ohio.
There are 2.8 million people that are registered in more than one state. So we'll vote here. Let's ride down the road. Let's vote next one. Maybe they'll vote for Trump. I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't be saying this. I may be hurting myself. You're right. You're right. Maybe they're going to vote for Trump. All right. Let's forget that. It's okay for them to do it.
So, voter fraud is okay. As long as it's in favor.
As long as it's on my behalf.
Yeah, as long as it's in favor of him. And remember, he said he'll support whatever the results are from the election, so long as they announce that he won. So that's what we're dealing with. In the meantime, maybe someone heard Donald Trump saying, hey, it's okay to commit voter fraud on behalf of me. A woman in Iowa was arrested late last week on suspicion of, yes, voting twice in the general election, according to police records on Friday. Terry Lynn Rote, a 55-year-old Des Moines resident, Des Moines, Iowa, was booked on Thursday on a first-degree charge of election misconduct, according to Polk County jails. The charge is considered a Class D felony. She was released after posting $5,000 bond. A hearing is scheduled for next week. The Des Moines Register reported that Rote is a registered Republican who cast 2 ballots in the general election, an early voting ballot at the Polk County Election Office and another at a county satellite voting location, according to police records. She hadn't planned on voting twice, she said, but it was a, quote, a spur-of-the-moment thing when she walked by the satellite voting location in Iowa. She told the Washington Post in a phone interview, over the weekend. She said, I don't know what came over me. She added she's been a supporter of Donald Trump since early in his campaign. After Republican Mike Huckabee had dropped out of the primary race, Rote told Iowa Public Radio that she had cast her first ballot for Trump, but feared it would be changed to a vote for Hillary Clinton. She said the polls are rigged. Wonder where she got that idea. And so she tried to vote twice. In addition to Rote, by the way, the Polk County, Iowa Auditor's Office reported two other people to police last week on suspicions of voter fraud, according to the Des Moines Register. In the other two cases, those people cast mail-in ballots, and then they also voted in person at one of the state's early voting locations, according to the paper. And as I've noted, yes, that's how fraud actually happens. Even if they showed their photo ID, it wouldn't have stopped that type of fraud from happening because they voted under their own name in person and via absentee. Now, Polk County Auditor Jamie Fitzgerald told the Des Moines Register that was the first time in 12 years that he could remember having to report possible voter fraud. And he says, correctly, that I think it shows that our voting system works in Iowa, that we were able to catch it. So he also adds the reported incidents could have been honest mistakes, obviously not a mistake in the case of the woman who voted twice in person, unless she's insane, which of course she could be. Well, she's a Trump supporter. That's all I'm saying. But it's not for the auditor to decide whether, it was on purpose or not. In the case of the absentee ballot, sometimes people forget. They don't know. Did I send it in? I can't remember if I sent in the absentee. They get all worked up. So that can happen. But it got caught, as it usually does in a case like that. Meanwhile, in Iowa itself, Clinton and Trump are now, it's a swing state. They are now locked in a dead heat, according to Quinnipiac University. This was a poll released just a couple of days ago, last week. Clinton and Trump are now tied in Iowa with 44% of the vote each. Election Day, by way of reminder, is November 8th. Don't let anyone tell you different. We're going to take a quick break, and we are going to talk more about Election Day, but not about Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. You're welcome. Well, there's a few other things on the ballot this year that we're going to continue trying to bring to light, as so many of them are being ignored on behalf of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump and the giant meteor. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. Don't go away.
California, I've been blue since I've been away from you. I can't wait till I get going. Even now, I'm starting in a color. California, here I come.
Yes, here we come.
Right back where.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Recreational marijuana could be legal in a quarter of the country following this year's election. Nancy Latorno recently wrote over at Washington Monthly. She said, I see a lot of parallels between what happened recently with marriage equality and what is beginning to happen with marijuana legalization. She cites a poll from Pew Research finding that the share of Americans who now favor legalizing the use of marijuana continues to increase. Today, some 57% of U.S. adults say the use of marijuana should be made legal, while 37% say it should be illegal. 57% to 37%. Now, a decade ago, she notes that the opinion on legalizing marijuana was nearly the reverse. Just 32% favored legalization just 10 years ago, with 60% opposed at the time. Now, recreational marijuana, as Russell Berman notes, can legally light up a joint in states representing about 5% of the U.S. population. By the time Americans wake up on November 9, however, that percentage could be more than one quarter. Measures to legalize and regulate the sale of cannabis are on the ballot in California, Arizona, Massachusetts, Maine, and Nevada, and recent polling shows that the yes vote is winning in all five states. Approval would mark the biggest advance yet for advocates in the decades-long fight over legalizing marijuana, one that they believe could ultimately force the federal government to end its prohibition of the drug. Well, for all the supposed power of conservatism in this country, they sure do a crappy job when it comes to policy on things like marijuana, on things like marriage equality. And yes, it is moving as fast as marriage equality moved in many cases when it comes to marijuana. Now, we've been trying on the program amidst all the extraordinary noise of this astonishing presidential election to focus a bit more over the past few weeks on some of the other items that are on the ballot around the country on November 8th, in addition to the one race that you've certainly heard about in the corporate media that we've covered as well. But the corporate media doesn't seem to cover anything else. The lack of issues coverage has been extraordinary this year, so I'm trying to make up for that a little bit of late, trying to cover what they are not. With control of the U.S. Senate up for grabs next Tuesday, with hundreds of millions in dark, undisclosed corporate dollars being spent to try and influence the outcome of those races, as well as the U.S. House races, state and local races, even elections for state Supreme Court justices, where, as we reported last week, a record amount of undisclosed corporate money is now being spent to buy control of state courts, with many of the judges there having to stand for election, not to mention the untold millions that are being spent on ballot initiatives around the country, like the purposely deceptive anti-solar power measure that was placed on the ballot by monopolistic fossil fuel utility companies in Florida, meant to hoax voters into believing that it's a pro-solar measure. That anti-solar ballot measure, we talked about it last week, is state constitutional amendment. Amendment 1 in the Sunshine State, and it is a fraud. When we discussed a week or two ago the Republican governor of Oklahoma, this was, Desi, you carried this on one of your Green News reports, the governor there, Mary Fallon, was literally announcing a day of prayer for the oil fields. Remember that?
Oh, yes.
A week or so ago? Because profits are down, apparently, in the oil fields due to oversaturation of the American energy market with fracking. Yes, they are putting themselves out of business in many ways with fracking, and it ain't the Obama administration doing it, unfortunately. We noted the budget shortfalls in Oklahoma due to the subsidies that oil companies in Oklahoma were getting, and that means that hundreds of millions of dollars in the meantime have been cut to school budgets by Governor Mary Fallon. In response to our coverage of that issue, we received an email from a listener named Chad. Yes, his name is Chad in Oklahoma. He writes to say, Brad just finished listening to the broadcast and the Green News report about Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon and school funding. This year, he says, we will vote on State Question 779, a ballot measure to increase the state's sales tax by one percentage point to generate education funds. And that is to make up essentially for this shortfall. He says, love all the work you do. Keep it up. Sincerely, Chad. He goes on to cite an article there about the difficult choice that voters in Oklahoma have to make. They have to raise their own taxes because of the deals, the subsidies that have been given to oil companies, and it's costing the kids. So it's sort of like a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. But that's what voters are facing now in Oklahoma because, you know, the oil fields come first. Pray for them. In the meantime, here in California, there are no fewer than 17 state measures on the ballot this year. One of them even has to do with whether porn film actors in California must use condoms. That is actually on the ballot out here. The official California General Election Voters Guide sent out to each household is 223 pages long. I am not kidding. 223 pages, seriously. Of course, that doesn't even include all of the county, city, school, and various district ballot measures in various jurisdictions as well. It's kind of embarrassing, to be frank, and it makes you wonder why we elect representatives in the first place. And it also makes you wonder if it's too easy to get stuff on the ballot. Our own Ernest A. Canning, BradBlog's legal analyst, has been writing about some of the measures on the California state ballot this year. He joins us now to talk about a few of the very important ones, important in some cases to the entire country. And we're going to talk about a bit more. Ernie Canning is BradBlog's, as I said, longtime legal analyst. He's a retired attorney. He's an author. He's a Vietnam veteran. And he's happily, he's back from a hiatus during the primary when he was working as a senior advisor to Veterans for Bernie. He's been covering some of these state ballot measures in California for us and trying to keep up with the various legal matters concerning election lawsuits on voter suppression and related matters around the country. Hey, Ernie, welcome back to the broadcast.
How you doing, Brad?
Hanging in there, my friend. Hope you are as well. And I want to get to some of these propositions, but you've been writing about them for us at BradBlog. But over the last few days, we've had quite a bit of behind-the-scenes legal action between the Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee. I want to hit that. In short, let me sort of summarize part of this. The DNC has filed a complaint in this long-running federal consent decree court order against the GOP, which, thanks to voter intimidation by the GOP back in the 80s, the Republicans are still barred from certain types of so-called ballot security programs and related Election Day activities that the court and the party itself have acknowledged were voter intimidation and suppression efforts back in the 80s. The Democrats have now filed to have that consent decree against the Republicans. It was supposed to expire at the end of next year, but now the Democrats want it extended for another 8 years, given what appears to be the RNC collusion with the Trump operation to carry out banned activities in this year's election, banned, you know, poll watching, voter intimidation activities. But now over the weekend, Ernie, the Democrats filed four separate voter intimidation lawsuits in Ohio, Arizona, North Carolina, Pennsylvania against the GOP state parties, I think, against Donald Trump and against this longtime GOP operative and Trump advisor, Roger Stone, a guy who goes a Republican dirty trickster, really, who goes back to the Nixon years. This was filed under the Ku Klux Klan Act. Very quickly, Ernie, what the hell are these lawsuits? What's the Ku Klux Klan Act? And what do the Democrats hope to achieve in filing these four suits in four different states in just days before the election?
Well, first off, all the suits, including the DNC versus RNC case, are federal court cases, not state court cases.
Okay.
They've filed in different federal courts, depending on which state they're in.
I see.
Starting with the first one, it's not really a complaint, which is what you initiate a lawsuit with, but a motion. And in the motion that they filed in the RNC case, that motion seeks to hold the RNC in contempt of court. It seeks an immediate injunction to stop the RNC from taking part in these voter intimidation tactics, and it seeks the extension of the consent decree.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple things that are really interesting that arise out of that, because it's the exact same tactic that the Trump campaign is engaged in now. And Roger Stone,
mm-hmm.
who's a Trump advisor now, had been a key advisor to New Jersey Governor Thomas Kean back in the 1980 campaign when they pulled this stuff up. You know, they were hiring off-duty police officers and basically going into minority neighbors and trying to intimidate people to prevent them from voting.
And that was the case that resulted in this consent decree that bars them from certain type of poll watching, right?
That's correct. And what that case does, now that's limited primarily to the relief is primarily limited to the RNC, but what all of these cases are being filed by attorney Mark Elias. If you remember, he was the one that represented Al Franken in that dispute with Coleman regarding who won the
2008 Senate race. Yeah,
right, and prevailed. And he's a very sharp attorney. And what he did in that case was he's alleging the critical issue there is not whether these so-called ballot security tactics are taking place, but whether the RNC is has colluded with the Trump campaign and Roger Stone to carry out these tactics. And what happened so far is the RNC, of course, is coming in alleging they aren't, and whereas Elias is making these allegations that there's been both direct and tacit support for them, all relating to this supposed excuse is they've got to protect against voter fraud, which, as you and I know, is a phantom menace. There was that study done and showed that only 31 cases of in-person voter fraud out of a billion votes cast in the last 14 years. So it just doesn't happen that often. And the one time they had it this year was a Trump supporter in Iowa.
Right. We talked
about that.
That got
caught. And Iowa, by the way, doesn't have photo ID, so they caught her even without the photo ID.
Well, and she wasn't impersonating a voter. She was going in as herself, and she got caught,
apparently. Trying to go twice, and they caught her.
But this, I want to hit, because I want to get to a break, and we'll come back and talk about the propositions. But what about these voter intimidation suits in Ohio, Arizona, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania?
Well,
what are those about?
Those ones are going directly after Trump. They're also seeking temporary restraining orders. They're going after the Trump campaign and the Republican state parties in each of those states, making essentially the same allegations. And it's being brought under the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871, which was the last of the enforcement acts that were passed after the Civil War during the Reconstruction period, to prevent this exact same thing of voter intimidation, and it makes it unlawful and allows the court to enjoin. So Elias's theory being advanced is that Trump is violating the KKK Act. So that's what those suits are, and the reason he had to file separate suits in those separate states was because of that. The interesting thing in the RNC case is the court has already issued this broad discovery order that compels the RNC to produce all the agreements it has with the Trump campaign pertaining to voter fraud, ballot security, poll monitoring, and poll watching. So that one's moving pretty quick.
And this is all going to happen within the next few days. The discovery has to come out within the next few days, and they got to make a decision on this. It looks to me like the Democrats, in any event, are playing hardball when it comes to what they fear could happen at the polls on November 8th with voter intimidation. I think that's a good thing. We'll see if they're successful. At least they're sending that message. Ernie, let me do this. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll run through all of these propositions that you've been covering. We'll try to fly through as many as we can. So sit tight. Ernie Canning, legal analyst at bradblog.com. We'll take a quick break and we will be back with more. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away. To the Bradcast, Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. I'm speaking with Ernie Canning. He is bradblog.com's long-serving legal analyst. And all right, let's hit some of these props, these state ballot initiatives on the California ballot, which are just amazing. There's at least, I think, 17 of them statewide. One of them that is getting a lot of play on the airwaves, a lot of play out here, is Prop 61. And here's an ad from the No on Prop 61 group, Ernie Canning, and then I'll let you respond to it as a veteran yourself.
When you raise your right hand, you're writing a blank check for your body. You're giving it to your country. Veterans sacrifice so much. The initiative would be terrible for veterans. They have to pay more for prescription drugs. It's not the way to go. It is important that they get those benefits because they suffered for them.
My name is Lamont. I'm a retired Marine, and I oppose this misleading initiative.
Wow, that sounds pretty terrible, Ernie. Prop 61, you're a veteran yourself. What does Prop 61 do, and why is this veteran against it in this ad that's been all over the airwaves out here?
Argument that this would somehow be harmful to veterans, I could start off right off the bat and say that it is the big lie technique. There is absolutely no truth to it. What it does is it prohibits the state of California from buying any prescription drug or at a price that is higher than the lowest price paid for the same drug by the Veterans, the Department of Veterans Affairs. And that price is set in federal law. It cannot be negotiated by, or unilaterally raised by the drug manufacturers. Mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders wrote an excellent op-ed on that. The troubling feature of this is that the pharmaceutical industry, which has such a monopoly control over prices and is gouging people right and left, has poured $109 million into this ad campaign.
How much?
$109 million. And not all of that $109 million went to buy the ads. It turns out, thanks to Li Fang, that we learn that some of that money has been funneled to several of the major veterans organizations and some supposedly progressive Democratic organizations to endorse their position on the No on 61 campaign.
So let me make sure I got this right. So Prop 61 basically says if you're a California state agency buying prescription drugs for whatever it is, Medi-Cal or any of those state agencies, then you cannot, the state will not pay more than the price that the Veterans Administration pays for those same drugs. And Veterans Administration, they get a discount. And so California, the state of California, would get that same discount, and now you've got the pharmaceutical companies coming out using veterans to say this will harm us somehow. This will harm the veterans. It doesn't make sense.
It can't. Not only do they not have they cannot unilaterally raise the price that they sell to the VA, but those are fixed under federal law. But the regardless, the veterans themselves, their co-pays are fixed by law, and this can have absolutely no impact on that. And in the case of veterans who are getting treated for service-connected conditions, they don't pay anything at all for their prescription medications. They get it for free. So it's absolute nonsense. This proposition, more than any other, shows you the problem with our money in our political system.
Mm-hmm.
They put these ads on, and naturally, the TV station that puts the ads on should say, hey, you know, we should fact check that. That's not true. But they're not going to do that because they're biting the hands that feeds them. You know, these ads have become a major source of revenue for our commercial media, and they're not doing their job.
Which is a point that I try to highlight. I know you've written about this before at the Brad blog, that all of this money that we're talking about, not all of it, but the bulk of it, when you talk about $109 million being spent by the pharmaceutical companies to block this thing, when they're spending that money, they're spending it by giving it to these TV and radio stations who make money hand over fist out of all of this corporate spending. So, of course, the mainstream corporate media is not going to spend a lot of time debunking these ads, rejecting these ads, or even letting the electorate know that, you know, all of this money after Citizens United and everything is actually going to them, is going to the media.
That's exactly right. The ultimate beneficiaries of Citizens United are the media, which is perhaps one of the reasons why they don't ask questions in debates about repealing Citizens United.
Good point. All right, let's move on to the death penalty. There are two different ballot initiatives in California concerning the death penalty, Prop 62 and 66. And as you wrote about a month or so at bradblog.com, it is a looming life or death decision between those two competing propositions.
62 is outright repeal of the death penalty. Includes provisions that would force the inmates to serve life without parole sentences, but also to their whatever restitution they or money they earn in prison would go to the families for restitution. And it's a straightforward measure which would save tons of money to the state of California. Prop 66 is the prosecutor's response to that somehow they could fix the system. Of the 900 human beings who have received death penalty, more than 900 since 1978, there have been a total of 13 executions at a cost of $5 billion, or about $384 million per execution.
And that we're just talking about California in that case, right?
Right.
900.
This is all California. There are 748 people on death row. The proposal 66 would basically cut appeal times, but it would also increase the likelihood that we're going to execute someone who's innocent. I gave people mm-hmm. who are really interested in this should read the article. It's a lot more, but I gave detailed cases of how certain people who died or certain people who were convicted and later turned out to be DNA proved them to be true. If they had these time periods in, those people would have been executed, and you'd bury your mistake.
So the bury your mistake. Good, well put. Prop 66. Essentially, they say we'll fix the death penalty. We'll fix the problem with all of these people on death row for decades at a time by shortening the appeal period.
Let me just read one thing to you that it was from this former public defender in the District of Columbia. Talked about, he says, it bears noting that in order to clear this backlog of 748 souls, that's the people on death row now,
right,
California would have to execute one person a day, every day, including Saturdays and Sundays and holidays, for more than 2 years. And if we did that, he suggests that California will forfeit its rightful seat at the table of a civilized, just, and peaceful people around the world.
And Prop 62 essentially would just end the death penalty once and for all in California. It's supported by California Democratic Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom. It's and former President Jimmy Carter supports this. Basically, it converts all of those death penalties into just life in prison without possibility of parole, and it saves a whole bunch of money for California in the bargain. Correct?
That's correct.
So that's Prop 62, and then 66 says, we'll kill them faster. So check out Ernie's piece on that, California's looming life or death decision. What happens if both of them pass? Ernie, any idea?
Well, it would be whichever has the most votes would be the one that would control.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Very interesting. Sure. All right, we got just a minute or two left here. I know Prop 59 is one that's been very important to you for a while, several years, actually. This is the Citizens United initiative. Very quickly, what is that? And, give us a quick history and now what it will mean this year if it passes.
It is a directive from the people of California to their elected representatives to support a constitutional amendment that would overturn Citizens United and, importantly, ensure that corporations are not entitled to the same constitutional rights as human beings. It was placed on the ballot at the request of the California legislature as a form of guidance. The principal argument against it, which the LA Times has come out, is, well, gee, it's just an advisory measure. It's just ballot clutter. It's probably the most important ballot measure that we have on the ballot because it goes to the core of everything else. The historical basis for this is, if you look at this type of advisory measure, California first, there was the 17th Amendment. California had, back in 1891, the legislature voted to place that issue on the 1892 ballot. It prevailed in a landslide at 93%. Other states followed suit with that, and eventually in 1913, the amendment allowing for direct election of U.S. senators came into law. So this is an important first step because it's an instruction to every member of the California delegation of Congress, plus our own state legislature. This is what the people want, and I think it's just critical if you value democracy that you vote for this.
That's Prop 59, and it had been it was supposed to be on the ballot 2 years ago, back in 2014, but it was removed over the legal wrangling of whether you were allowed to have a mere advisory measure on the ballot. So this basically says, hey, we, the people of California, would like our legislators to know that we want, essentially, we want money out of politics, that, the Constitution, the rights should apply to actual human beings, not corporations. And it's sending a very clear signal if it passes. That's Prop 59, Citizens United.
By the way, I think it's important that it not just pass, but everybody make sure that it gets the kind of overwhelming support that the 17th Amendment got and try and pass this by at least 80%.
Well, yeah, and that will even send a clearer message, indeed. All right, very quickly, Prop 54 would legalize the recreational use of marijuana, would end this decades-long prohibition. Thoughts on Prop 54, Ernie Canning?
Well, it's a vital, important first step in what I think is essentially what we need of an end of all narcotics prohibition in the United States. Over the last 40 years, I'm quoting Amy Goodman from this, over the last 40 years, there have been more than 45 million drug-related arrests in the United States at a cost of $1 trillion. Yet drugs are cheaper, purer, and more available today than ever. And actually, the reality is counterintuitive. Prohibition increases narcotics consumption. In Portugal, they've had an experiment with decades-long experiment of decriminalization of all narcotics, and that's produced a 50% reduction in all drug abuse. When it comes to marijuana, which is probably the least dangerous of all controlled substances, there was a study done a couple of years ago by a researcher, John Getman, now this is nationwide, that we squander $43 billion a year controlling the least dangerous drug, and that's broken down into $10.7 billion in direct law enforcement costs and $31.1 billion in lost revenues. In California, these drug war expenditures have affected other areas of public service. In 1980, 10% of California's budget was devoted to higher education and only 3% to prison. By 2010, 11% went to prisons and only 7.5% to higher education. And we have, as a result of Nixon's declaration of the war on drugs, we've expanded, more than quadrupled the number of people in prisons. There are two perverse financial incentives. One is obviously privately owned prisons, but the other one is that these have created a huge pool of prison slave laborers and some of the largest corporations, the same ones that outsource jobs, are coming back to insource so they can get 17 cents an hour prison slave labor to do their products.
Indeed. Ernie, I got to get out. I'm going to point folks, because you've done some great work on this over the years at bradblog.com. If they go to bradblog.com, search for War on Drugs, they'll find your, I think it was a 3 or 4 part series you did on that a couple of years ago.
Yeah, there'll be a new article coming in specifically on this that I've got drafted already that you'll have to take a look at.
I will look forward to that. Unfortunately, we didn't even get time to have you ring in on adult film condoms, but we'll have to do that at another time. That's Prop 60. But Prop 54 is the marijuana legislation. Ernie Canning, check out his work as ever between now and Election Day and beyond, I suspect, at bradblog.com. Thank you, Ernie. Great catching up with you. And I think we may have a busy week or two ahead of us.
I think so. Hopefully it'll be finally over.
I hope so, and I hope it's a really dull week or two, but I doubt it. All right. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it for free anytime at bradblog.com or over at iTunes, where we hope you'll give us a good review as well. Make it easier for everyone else to find us. Send me email if you like. I'm, who am I? I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am simply The Brad Blog. All right. My thanks to you. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.